playback on RT Radio 1. Sponsored by the all-new Irish Times Weekend. With new writers like Marion Keyes and Sean Moncrief, your weekend's in good hands.
So, it's the summer and the children are in the back of the car shouting,
"Are we there yet? Are we there yet? Are we there yet?"
Mary Wilson from Drive Time. She was actually asking David Lennon from the Echo newspaper about the end of the European election count in Ireland South.
"Are we there yet, David? Is it done?"
"Everything is finally over 12 days after the boxes were first opened. I think that's the longest count in Irish political history. So last week we had Sean Kelly and Billy Kelleher, who were both deemed elected. This afternoon they were joined by Mick Wallace, who surpassed the quota, and his surplus gave Grace O'Sullivan the fourth seat, and Deirdre Clune is in the fifth seat. She has a seat, but she won't be able to go until the UK leaves the European Union."
David Lennon from Drive Time. And for the same programme, Louise Byrne spoke to Mick Wallace, the new MEP.
"My dad is long dead, but he was mad about politics. He was an amazing man, much better man than I'll ever be. And he would have loved it to bits."
"It's an emotional day."
"No, I'm fine." "Sorry. I just have to go to Brussels now and try and make a difference."
There's one place Mick won't be going, and that's to a golf resort in a village in West Clare.
This afternoon, US President Donald Trump will touch down at Shannon Airport before flying...
Just in case you're in any doubt where President Donald Trump was visiting, Tommy Tuberty was on with Ryan Tuberty to talk about the Trump visit. And a bit like those bets people make before wedding speeches, Tommy seems to have had a bet that he could squeeze a certain number of mentions of the village into 15 seconds of airtime.
"Well, we're very excited in Dunbeg, and I'm delighted that he is coming to Dunbeg. He's a man we appreciate in Dunbeg. His family are very well got in Dunbeg. They've invested a lot of money in Dunbeg. They came into Dunbeg and bought Dunbeg Resort when there was a recession here in this country."
Tommy, of course, had a more serious point to make.
"Where would you see it? They're on a shuttle service from their local resort and bring them into the village. The support, we have three restaurants and we have five bars in the village, which is kind of unreal now for here in the west of Ireland and the way things are going. You know, the places are closing down. Our post office has closed. Our guard station has closed. And here we have this resort here in Dunbeg that implies over 300 people.
Let's just put 300 jobs in West Clare into context.
This is Jennifer Zamparelli on our new show on 2FM.
So if the population of the village of Dunbeg and surrounding areas is around 1,000 people, 300 jobs is like the equivalent of like Facebook and Google combined. I mean, it's massive.
And the show had a reporter
in Dunbeg
talking to local people.
"Well, great time for him. He's a great man. He's a great man, yeah."
"Yeah, he's great for business, good for the area, so we're happy to see him come."
"Delighted. Delighted. Absolutely delighted."
While Jennifer read reaction from listeners.
And some of you were texting in and saying, you know, your morals have a price.
Evelyn O'Rourke was there and spoke to one of those protesting against Donald Trump's visit. She's Anne-Marie Harrington, a Clare resident who's an environmental campaigner. She's against President Trump, but is kind of glad that he came.
"For us, it isn't really about Trump. We've been campaigning for longer than this. We've been campaigning about issues irrelevant to Trump because we're living in the county most vulnerable to climate breakdown. We have wild Atlantic storms here that used to be once in a generation and now they happen every second year. And literally, our home place is shrinking. So Trump, for us, has been a blessing in his own way because it's given us a stage and a platform to talk about these things that we didn't have before."
Anne-Marie Harrington on Today with Sean O'Rourke.
"Tá an tuachtar an Trump agus a bhean chéile Melania, directoris Turling."
Down at Shannon Airport, Micheál O'Loughlin was broadcasting live for Radio na Gaeltachta from the peace camp, Shia Conn. While he was on air, Micheál came up against the men in black with their spakely greina, sunglasses, and was hurried, rusty, onto a bus.
"Agus over míleta in the start yéntathe, go trean an seo, galor lor farav will come on dar éire orto siúl tímpel, spakely greina orto, agus iad ag fecan gahóra so chair gachal agana ta siasta tímpel. Ta mis av rustu ar bus an seo ar fristan ta brónarum
kahamit huag. Micheál O'Loughlin with Tristan Rosenstock on Radio na Gaeltachta. Meanwhile, back up in Dunbeg, the Trump sons went on a pub crawl.
"The woman who raised me is Irish, so I spent a lot of my youth in Ireland, and it really does feel like this is a second home for us, and we've invested a tremendous amount of money in the property and the local economy, and you see it paying off in spades when you see these crowds and the amount of support we have, and it's just a special thing. We love them, they love us. It's been an unbelievable partnership, and it's been an unbelievable friendship. And you have the head priest, Father, and he's going around. He's on every major newspaper in the world saying, "I saved a spot in heaven for all of the Trumps." It was the greatest line. It was so kind. He is an amazing man. And again, we just can't thank everybody for the friendships. This response is incredible.
From Cian McCormack's report on Morning Ireland. Actually, before Morning Ireland, Shea Byrne on Rising Time had the first bite of the story.
Pat's been on. Just to clarify, the Trump brothers visited 4 pubs last night in Doonbeg. They went to Morrissey's, the Igo Inn, Comerford's and Tuberty's, where they bought everyone a drink, including me. And that's from Pat.
As someone wrote to Playback at RTE to say, if this person was drinking in 4 pubs with free drink, how are they fit to send a text to Shea Byrne at 6:30 the next morning? When Des Cahill came on with Shea, he had other concerns.
You're now giving mentions to people who visit 4 pubs in the night. I mean, your like thrice weekly visit to 4 pubs in North County Wicklow never makes the radio. Can the Trumps have no privacy?
Drink featured in the most suggested interview this week. The comedian Dylan Moran was on with Ray Darcy. But not the lugubrious Dylan Moran you may remember from past appearances, but someone entirely more chipper. Because he's given up drink.
Because you were known back in the day for arriving out with a glass of white wine and a cigarette.
Yeah.
You've changed.
Yeah.
Well, you can't have the cigarette anymore, can you?
No, you can't.
The workplace ban.
It's everything that I think I'm like a lot of people now with fags, as we call them here, with cigarettes. You know, it's very hard to believe you ever did. That's what happens to you. I mean, I don't know if you ever did, but if you did, it's just you go, what? What was that about? How did I do that for 27 years? Like sucking in exhaust. It's amazing to me. Yeah. But you know, it's obviously, that's everywhere now. Everybody's giving up. But drink's another thing. I've stopped. You kind of have to make a public announcement in Ireland. I'm breaking it to people.
You nearly have to make a case for not drinking. You know, it's the only drug that you have to make a case for not doing, isn't it?
Well, yeah, it is, because it's social glue. You know, it's the thing. And it's like it's like saying, I'm going to take away the fireplace. You know, it's what people gather around. I mean, that's, you know, especially in Ireland, as we all know. I mean, it's used as so many things. It's like it's a magical thing, alcohol, almost, just because it's used. You can say it's used medicinally. It's used socially. It's social oil for everything. And then it can also, you know, burn your house down, and it can do all kinds of things.
Yeah. Ruin your relationship.
Yeah.
Why did you decide?
Well, I just got really tired. Do you know, to give you the boring answer, I was just really, really tired. And I thought, I feel ghastly. And I wanted, you know, to see what it was like.
Yeah, what's your experience?
Well, it's weird. I mean, you know, I don't know. It's kind of, I haven't thought about it enough, to be honest with you. I haven't even written about it yet because not really, because I'm still thinking about it. It's still happening. It's like, because it's kind of like a lot of stuff being cleared away rather than gaining anything. You know, it's sort of like raking leaves off your windscreen or something.
But the fog is gone.
Yeah,
is
you're
that
trying
it?
To get used to a new way of looking at the picture. I'm in midlife, so are you. So, you know, everybody you know probably is talking about what bit of them is falling off or rolling away, you know, and what they're doing to stop it. And you sit down, you go to sit down opposite a dinner table, opposite somebody else, and the first thing they say to you is, I've given up bread. And you think, oh, here we go. That's this evening, you know, that's what we're going to talk about. Help me.
Which is boring.
It's terrible. It's awful.
Yeah, yeah,
you know,
yeah.
The first half of life seems to be all about, you know, how to get out of it. And the second half is all about how to stay in it.
Yeah. Well, you don't purposely want to get out of it, but everything you do conspires
exactly,
to get you out of it.
Having a good time is what you call getting out of it. And then later on, having a good time is still being in it. It's just, the truth is, I wasn't really in my body. And this is really boring. And then
No, it's not. It's fascinating.
No,
I'm
it's
fascinated.
Terrible. It's of course you're fascinated. Do you know why you're fascinated?
Why am I fascinated?
Because you're old and you're going to die soon, like me. Of course you're fascinated. This is what I mean. You get real perky. You get a lot of attention. Anybody looks well, you're right on them. You go, hey, hi. What are you putting on your cereal in the morning? Hello. It's hilarious.
Dylan Moran with Ray Darcy on Radio 1. The gardener Helen Dillon did her own brand of hilarious on The Business with Richard Curran.
I did actually do a talk in Alaska at one point, and they'd arranged without telling me that I was going to go on this sledge. you're lying on the snow, and the sledge runs over the snow, and in front of you are 8 or 10 large dogs that look like
these
wolves.
Husky
that,
dogs.
They're very sweet. What are they called?
Huskies, is it? Or
Huskies, that's what they're called. Yeah. Huskies, yes. And anyway, what they don't tell you is all the dogs, when it comes to going to the loo, none of the dogs actually stop, but all the dogs decide at the same time they need to go to the bathroom. So basically, you're lying on the ground being pulled over on speed, and suddenly this sort of shower of shit sort of hits you in the eye. and that was so if you go to Alaska, whatever you do, take an umbrella in front of you.
Helen Dillon with Richard Curran on The Business. Grainne Briscoe told Joe Duffy of an escapade she had. She sounded pretty unfussed about it, even though she was talking about nearly dying.
You fell under a moving train.
I did, yes. On the in September 1983, I was on my way to my friend's wedding, and I was with her sister. We were on our way to it was in France. We were on our way to the hairdressers,
right?
And we were running along the platform, rushing, you know, to get out of the station, and I slipped and I fell under a moving train.
What? And is this the metro or?
No, it was a train. It was in Versailles.
Come on, hang on. You slipped.
Yeah, you... my feet, and I slid towards the train.
And did you see the train coming towards you?
Well, no, I kind of was sideways. You know, no, the train was already, like, I came out the side of it, not in the front of the train. I didn't fall in front under it. I fell in sideways. So my two legs went in, and I got jammed then by the step of the at the door on one side. Then I got dragged along, between the train and the platform, and then I got flipped over completely.
Water
and imagine, yeah. Now imagine I was flipped in that space and my head never hit.
And what did you think was happening?
Well, I assumed I was going to die, because to what other outcome was it? So I kind of was accepting that.
Could you hear people screaming?
Yeah, I could hear all the people screaming on the platform.
And did the train driver hear people screaming? How did the train stop?
The train stopped, yes.
Yeah.
But I was now, for some moments, I don't know how long, going along, and my two legs were up. And that's all the people could see, was my two legs being dragged along. And my head, the wheel was spinning around at my head, you know. And then when the train stopped,
yes,
and I fell completely down and I was now lying like by the track, I kind of assumed I was dead, because I was going to die, if you know what I mean. So
yeah.
I assumed I was dead. And then I heard all
and
the
that, people... And that heaven was a train station. That is the most incredible story. You're running.
I know, isn't it? Yeah.
What age are we growing at this age?
I was 20.
You're running.
Yeah.
Was it an oily slick? What did you trip? Did you trip over a gap? Did your shoe go from under you?
I'd say shoes might have been slippy or something like
that.
I really don't know.
So you trip. You roll down between a moving train and the platform.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I was dragged along.
Yeah, that's what I mean. The moving train. How did the moving train grab you, so to speak?
The gap was too wide, you know, the mind, the gap thing, that's for a reason. So the gap was too wide for a body to and that I was able to go in. And the step then of the train jammed me, caught me, the step at the door.
Oh, and that's what was dragging you.
Yes,
okay.
And that's what was dragging
your head. Back. Your head is now lying on the ground, so to speak.
Yes,
okay.
Yes.
Are you bouncing off the gravel?
No, I was suspended. No, it was extraordinary. Like,
wow.
This was all probably only moments, seconds, I don't know.
And then the wheel, you could see, you said you could see
the steel wheel. The wheel of the train turning at my head, yeah.
How close to your head?
I don't know, it must have been right beside it, you know. Just whatever little gap there is between the wheel and the wall of the platform.
So the train train comes to a halt. You're now distended. Your legs are up in the air, so to speak.
No, I fell then, you see. My legs
fell.
Oh,
you dropped under the step.
I dropped down, completely. Yeah.
And that's when you thought you'd died and gone to heaven.
Oh, but that's how I thought I was dead, yes. Yeah.
So what happened next?
And my last thought, because I thought I was dying, was in French. I was thinking in French, le jour du mariage de Manu, which was the day of Emmanuel's wedding. All I could think of was, I've ruined the wedding.
Yeah.
That's all I could think of. I wasn't thinking of my mother and my father and heaven and hell. I was just thinking of, I've ruined a wedding, you know. And then somebody came and caught me by the shoulders and lifted me up and put me standing on the platform. And anyway, next thing, there was a policeman. And sorry, the bride's sister was with me. Because I was doing the reading in the church, and there were 650 people come to this wedding. This was a huge, big society wedding. And all I could think of was, then you get this big adrenaline rush.
Yeah.
And I felt no pain. And all I had was single-minded. We had to go to the hairdresser, and I had to go to the wedding. And a policeman came and said, you've got to go to hospital. And I said, no, I'm grand.
I've only fallen under a moving train. Don't be so hysterical. Qu'est-ce que c'est?
The people were hysterical, exactly. Everyone else was hysterical. And they were all coming over to touch me.
Yeah.
Because they couldn't believe it. And anyway, we came out, and then I saw firemen and ambulances and fire engines. And I said to the policeman, I honestly, it wasn't that I was downplaying it. I genuinely didn't see the enormity of what had just happened. And I said to the policeman, I said, did something happen here? And he swept his hand out and he said, no, all of this is for you. And I said, no, we haven't time. And
he said, get me to the church on time.
Yeah, basically. So we got whipped off to the hospital. X-ray. They said, we have to X-ray your head. I mean, you can't fall under a train and not, you know. So they strapped two of my fingers together, said I had a broken finger. And I had a bad friction burn from being dragged along, you see. And off we went to the hairdresser, went to the wedding, did the reading in the church. I was the bridesmaid-ish kind of witness as well, you see. So I had to sign the register, and then she looked at my fingers and said, what happened to you? We were up on the altar signing the register. And then I told, and then there's the two of us crying up at the altar.
And did you do your reading in Francais?
Yes.
Do you remember what it was?
Yeah, it was that famous lecture de la lettre de Saint Paul aux Épîtres, the letter of Saint Paul to the Apostles. You know, the one, the love is...
Oh, yeah, love is not cruel or kind. Love has no seasons. Love has no... Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
And love is being on the right track all the time, but preferably not under a moving train.
That was it.
Yeah.
But then we went along to the wedding, and the French are so dramatic. And then I was sitting in a chair like the miraculous one, and they were all coming over. They all wanted to touch my hand. Honestly.
As if you were saying the relic of St. Therese of Lisieux.
I was the relic. Yes, yes.
Grainne Briscoe on Liveline.
Have you got a note?
Marty Whelan on Lyric FM had the O'Neill sisters in studio with them.
Trains and boats and planes were passing by. They mean a trip to Paris or Rome to someone else, but not for me. The trains and the boats and planes took you away, away from me. We were so in love, like high above. We had a star to wish upon wish, and dreams came true, but not for me. The trains and the boats and planes took you away, away from me.
A blameless life could allow you to sing like that. You've done nothing wrong in your entire life.
The O'Neill sisters with Marty Whelan on Lyric FM in the morning. And as usual, Marty had his string of listeners texting in their jokes.
Marty, U2's first few albums, yes, have been remastered without the guitars on them, says Tony. It certainly takes the edge off them. Ah, very good. Very, didn't see that coming, Tony. Very good, very good. Anthony tells us that puns about opticians just get cornier and cornier. I think he's right.
Except one of them threw Marty with an abstract sort of anti-joke.
Okay, this is a joke for this morning from Maria Cummins. I ate four cans of alphabet soup. And the joke is, I don't know. I don't understand that one. Sorry, I know. Like a joke to me. Like Anthony McLaughlin sent us a joke. He said he went to Sweden to see some fjords, but all I saw was Volvos. That's a joke. What do you call a hippie's wife? Mississippi. I think that's a joke. If anyone knows a cure for earwax, give us a shout. That's funny.
Marty Whelan's School of Jokes on Lyric FM in the morning.
Playback on RTE Radio 1.
There was a lot about words on the radio this week. John Creedon had a bit of Portuguese.
Mashcanada.
2FM had a brand new word.
Bev.
And Sean O'Rourke had some words that shouldn't be used.
Very, rather, really.
And we'll get to all of them in a moment, but surely the word that changed meaning most dramatically during the week was this one.
Undisputed.
We woke up to it on Sunday morning.
Katie Taylor has beaten Delphine Persoon of Belgium to become the undisputed lightweight boxing champion of the world.
Mick, darling, good morning to you.
Good morning, Marion.
Well, how would you rate it? How did she do?
Simply, she is the cleaner boxer, the better puncher. She delivers the better punches. And it's not all about how many punches you throw. It's not about how much you go forward and rough up your opponent. It's about the scoring punches. And I feel, and I like to feel, that Katie won it because she was the classier, better quality puncher.
Mick Dowling with Marion Finucane. But soon the word undisputed became disputed and even heavily disputed. This is Greg Allen from Drive Time.
A rematch is inevitable with Persoon after a decision on Saturday night, which was heavily disputed by the Belgian, who's to file an official complaint about the decision with the New York Athletic Commission. Persoon's team are currently in the process of analysing the fight sequence by sequence, but she has accepted that such a complaint is unlikely to be successful in spite of numerous observers, including Carl Frampton and Kenny Egan, saying that the Belgian policewoman should have won the contest.
Then on Game On 2FM, Hugh Cahill and Gary Murphy carried on the discussion about Katie Taylor. Not the one about her in Madison Square Garden, but the one everyone was talking about. Katie Taylor in Dublin Airport.
I was watching Katie's homecoming today and I couldn't help but think it takes a special type of arrogance and an absence of humility to do what the Minister for Sport, Shane Ross, did so brazenly at Dublin Airport today. Katie arriving home through the gates, big crowd there to greet her, and I watched Shane Ross not only stand right beside Katie Taylor, but actively seek out every camera lens, every flash of photography, every crew that were trying to focus in on Katie Taylor. And I could just feel my face contort with this sense of this. I was, what am I watching here? I did think it would be impossible to trump Charles J. Haughey's Stephen Roach homecoming when he won the Tour de France over in France, and there's our Taoiseach standing there by his side. Yeah. I thought that would be pretty difficult to trump. But actually, what I watched today did beat that hands down. And I just thought it was pathetic. What are you doing? Why are you there? Why are you standing at every single photo opportunity for the entirety of the time? Can you not let her have her moment in front of her fans without your presence being there? It was totally unnecessary.
It was. The only thing I will say in his defence, and I've never wanted to defend politicians very often, but, you know, the government grants that a lot of our sporting heroes get helps them, you know, along their way. So maybe he felt because of that he was in some way responsible.
If Katie Taylor was still an amateur and she was coming back from a European Championships or a World Championships or an Olympic Games, that might hold some water, albeit still the level of brass neckery that was going on today just had to be seen to be believed. But she is a professional fighter now. So nothing that she does as a pro is in any way, you know, to be beholden to the government for. She's done it all on her own. Maybe. She's done it all on her own the hard way over there. She comes back home after unifying the lightweight division and this is what happens.
I think you're missing the point, though. You know, there could be an election before the end of the year.
Yeah.
You know, it's important to get your face in the crowd.
It is.
From Game On 2FM and on the Tracy Clifford Show on 2FM, for competition winner Ellen, Katie Taylor is still a hero.
Actually, what would you say instead of best of luck to leaving a junior certs, would you say, Ellen?
Smash it like Katie Taylor.
Yes!
The exams also came up on the 2FM Breakfast Show, where Dhiren Garrahy recalled the Aral Irish tape.
Le anish go cormach na scrúd fá pair. Na trárocha agus na chistana a gháin le quid a. Boop. Cora a hean. Boop.
As mesha sheila le lunchag, Tóma Maconi a gáin na nál, tá birch tar fóracha a gum, and so on.
That's truly wonderful. Hey, your setup was, you were veering towards Dahi O'Shea there.
Was I?
Yeah.
Oh, I'd say Dahi would love to have the leaving sort of job. He'd bring a bit of crack to this screw-do, what is it called? Listening test.
Screw-do listening test, that's the one.
Dearan Garrahy from the new 2FM Breakfast Show with herself and Owen McDermott, and I should say Ruth Jeffson from AA Roadwatch, because after Ruth did the usual traffic stuff, she did this.
Ruth Jeffson, traffic in the style of Stormzy, Vossy Bop, Take It Away.
Murky, ki, 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 ki. Like, whether you drive or get the train or bus, or riding red and green lines on the loo, worse. All that coinage from your ticket got you nonplussed. A Roadwatch, any issues you can check with us. A, whether you drive or get the train or bus, or riding red and green lines on the loo, worse. All that coinage from your ticket got you nonplussed. A Roadwatch, any issues you can check with us. A, you ain't got a clue, let's be honest. You gotta get your traffic in for farmers. The level of our research would astonish. We'll get you from your bed to school or office. A, whether you're in Tume or Claremorris, Mullinavat, 2 Mile Barris, we'll cover everywhere, that's a promise. Travel news from Rosslare to Ballyhonus. In the morning, giving you a warning, providing all the updates when the traffic got you crawling. I feel you cause I know what times the queues can be appalling. AA Roadwatch, so we here in D and E have got you lolling. Oh! That's it.
Oh, Ruth Jeffson!
Oh my God!
Unbelievable scenes, Ruth Jeffson!
Ruth Jeffson on the new breakfast show on 2FM. The show has come up with something new for breakfast shows. Normally, breakfast shows have a male-female team who are effortlessly cheery, but Dearan and Owen can, at times, sound like a normal married couple in the morning, just a bit snarky. As if, for example, she's at him for making a show of himself at the party last night.
I feel like you need to get new jokes.
It's old.
Like, it's like when you get a joke and it semi-works.
Yeah.
You just drag the arse out of it.
Yeah.
Don't do that. It's not cool.
Hey, it's nice to work with you, Jared. I hope you're enjoying day two.
Dearan and Owen also keep you up to date with a story that Morning Ireland over on the other channel has completely missed. What's happening in Love Island, of course.
Amber is really annoying because she keeps saying she's a diva. She's like, I'm a right diva. I'm a diva, blah, blah, blah. You know one of these people who says what their negative trait is, thinking that it makes it okay?
Oh, God, I'm always late for everything.
I was going to use late as an example. I'm always late.
So rude, yeah.
Okay, cool. Just don't be late. If you are aware of it, it makes you an even worse person.
Yeah. Do you reckon Shane Ross knows he's real sticky?
He definitely doesn't know. But Lucy then is trying to make the word Bev happen. Bev. It's her way of describing an attractive man, but she's admitted she made it up herself. She's trying to make it catch on, like fetch in Mean Girls, and it's just not happening.
Yeah. In the villa, you're probably going to hear some new and weird words. Bev Nishtopf. A Bev is a hot guy. If he's your boyfriend, he's your Bev. But if he's not your boyfriend, he's a Bev.
What type of outfit are you going for tonight?
I'm wearing
it. Bevy or not Bevy? What does Bevy mean, please?
So Bevy means sexy.
So I'm wearing this.
That's Bevy.
What do you think of
your Bev?
Your Bev.
My Bev.
Anton the Bev. Anton's Bev.
Bev. A new word from the new breakfast show on 2FM. On Radio 1, Sean O'Rourke was also dealing with words. He was talking to Benjamin Dreyer about the correct use of English.
You set readers a challenge in this book early on that there are certain words they should give up writing for a week with a view to improving their writing. I don't know if you've got the book in front of you or the back cover, but do you want to tell us those words or what they are?
Yes, they're the words, I refer to them as the WAN intensifiers, and we all use them, and we certainly use them all the time when we're speaking. It's just that in prose, it's nice to sort of prune them away, and they include very, rather, really, quite, in fact, and the one that I used to use all the time. Well, I have to stop myself from saying it. I certainly stop myself from writing it. I'm a great abuser of the word actually.
So, how would one's writing improve then by just excluding those particular words?
Yeah, I think that, you know, and what I say is I say to writers, you know, write them all you want. But then when you're having that second go through, when you're looking at your work, basically just go through and cross them all out. All they're doing is throwing a little bit of sort of unnecessary emphasis that you think is making your writing stronger. And all it's really doing is covering it up in like in the sort of packing peanuts that you would put in a box to hold something, but they're not the thing. They're just stuff.
And what are the things you refer to as trimmables? What are they?
Oh, the trimmables are the little sort of they're little sort of redundancies where you'll use two words when really one is going to take care of it. I mean, for instance, you talk about joining together something, and it's like, well, all you really need to say is join. Or people make a reference to an end result when all you really need is a result, or past history when all you really need is history.
Future plans, I think, is in there too.
Future plan.
And the confusables is a very interesting chapter. The difference between everyday and every day, and emigrate and immigrate, or eminent, imminent and imminent, or envelope or envelope, epigram and epigraph, and so much more. It's an absolute treasure.
Benjamin Dreyer with Sean O'Rourke on the words to be wary of in English. John Creedon's word interest was in Portuguese, and the phrase
mashcanada. It is Portuguese, mashcanada. It's really a colloquial expression in Brazil. The best translation would be, even though it's not a literal translation, but it would be a kind of a sarcastic, yeah, right.
He was, of course, talking about this because it's the title of a Sergio Mendes hit.
Pois o samba está animado, o que eu quero é samba. Este samba que é misto de maracatu, é samba de preto veio, samba de preto du. Mas que nada, um samba como este é tão legal. Que eu quero passar, pois o samba está animado. O que eu quero é samba. Este samba que é misto de maracatu, é samba de preto veio, samba de preto du. Mas que nada, um samba como este é tão legal. Você não vai querer que eu chegue no final.
Mashcanada from the John Creedon Show on Wednesday. Earlier in the week, you may have seen the video online of the cruise ship hitting the quayside in Venice.
We heard this enormous bang. Now, we didn't know what it was. I thought it was something that happened in the kitchen.
Irish woman Margaret Galligan was on that ship, and she told Mary Wilson on Drive Time that that incident meant that she and her husband couldn't get off the ship on time to catch their flight home.
So we went up anyway, and we said to them at the help desk, how are we going to get home?
Because you'd missed your flight at this stage, Margaret.
Oh, yes.
Your flight had left at 1 or 2 o'clock.
Yeah. And other people had missed theirs as well. It wasn't just Tommy and I. And the answer that they gave us was, and this went on for 3 solid hours, you've got to get off the ship and make your own way home, and we will give you the added expense of what your ticket was for to come on the flight, right? So I just said, because my son-in-law had gone up to Cassidy's Travel, and they said to them, tell them not to leave the ship, because once you leave the ship, they've no comeback.
I see, yeah.
So I said to your man behind the desk, I said, we've no money. Where are we to fly home? And this went on and on and on until 6 o'clock. And he said, I said, what part of this conversation do you not understand? I said, you don't understand. My husband has Parkinson's. It's dystonia, but it's a brother and sister to Parkinson's.
Yeah.
And I said, my husband has Parkinson's. Our case is out there since last night. His medication is in it. Because they come the night beforehand and take our cases.
Oh, so you had packed up and the cases were already gone,
our
Margaret.
Case went at 1 o'clock in the morning.
I see. So you had nothing with you? You'd none of your personal items?
Nothing. Not one solid thing. So he said, well, I don't know, like, you know, it's their policy. We are... But I said, it's your fault. We didn't hit your ship. It's not our fault.
And at this stage, Margaret, you're still on the ship.
Oh, yeah.
But they want you...
We didn't leave the ship at 6:15, Tommy and I. Because I said, we have no money. You're not listening to me. We don't have money to fly home. So we said then, is there anybody that can help you, that can put money onto your card or anything? And I said, who's going to pay back them if I ring them and ask them for money? Who's going to pay them back? And he turned around and he said, well, we will. So I said, well, can I have that in writing or anything? And he just gave me a card.
And so, Margaret, were they offering you a hotel? Were they offering
nothing,
you any advice about
nothing,
where you could go?
Nothing, not one single thing. Until 6:15, he said to me, if you ring your son-in-law and ask him, can he put money on your card? And then you book tickets and we will reimburse you.
But at that stage, Margaret, as well, I presume there wasn't a direct flight back to Dublin.
No, no. Wait till I tell you, but you haven't heard of this yet. So that was okay. So Ray said, okay, I'll do that. And then I said to him, we hung up, can you book us a ticket? They wanted us to fly to Germany and from Germany to Dublin. So I said, well, my husband couldn't fly to Germany. He's not able for the connections. But in the long run, anyway, he said, well, even I took up to stay till Tuesday because there's no other flight. So I said, right, we'll go to the airport, and they got us a taxi. We paid €50 for the taxi to the airport. We get to the airport, and the girl said, there's no flights here going to Germany. They're all booked out.
So you're now at Venice Airport. Your baggage,
yes.
You didn't know where your baggage was?
No, they had lost our baggage then, and we had to sit in the taxi outside of the Marco Polo terminal while somebody looked for our luggage.
In the meantime, your husband Tommy needs his medication. That's in the bags.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. This was from 1 o'clock the night before, Mary. This was nearly, like, I've done it many more hours. It was probably, what time was this, near 7 o'clock, because we were trying to get there to get to hospital.
And you don't have flights and you don't have a hotel?
We had nothing. I swear, we had nothing.
You must have been very worried.
I started crying anyway. When we got to the hotel, I started crying. It was more so for Tommy because he has a very bad... Anybody that knows him, and he's a lovely man. And he never complains, but he said, Margaret, I feel I'm going to faint with disease.
Oh.
So we got to the airport. I went to the ticket desk and I said to the girl, they had given us a piece of paper for us to book 2 tickets to Germany and 2 tickets from Germany to Ireland. Now, you have to understand we were paying for this ourselves.
Yes.
Still no money had passed. So when I get to the desk anyway, and I queue up, and we'd only about 20 minutes to catch the plane, the girl said, no, there's no tickets going, no tickets left, and that flight's booked up. But I said, it can't be, because they're after telling us on the ship that there was tickets on it, or seats on it. She said, no, that flight's booked up. So then I started crying. I'm telling you the truth. I said, well, I don't know what we're going to do, I said. So she said, I said, when can we get back to Dublin? And she said, tomorrow at 2:15. And I said, how much is that? And she said, €1,100.
€1,100 for two tickets, two one-way tickets to Dublin?
€1,100. I have the receipts and all. So I said, we'll rebook them. So we booked them and we paid €1,100. And then I said to her, do you know anywhere we could stay tonight? And she said, no, I have no idea. But there was a boy there and he worked for the MSC, the cruise ships, just bringing on and off cases.
Yeah.
And I said to him, do you know anywhere we could stay tonight? And he said, I'll try and get you a hotel. Because I was really bad at this time. So he came back and he said, I got you a hotel. How much do you want to pay? And I said, well, whatever decent hotel is. And he said, well, there's one here for €125.
And that all happened, did it, Margaret?
Everything happened. We went to the hotel. We stayed in the hotel. We got up this morning. We had a bit of breakfast. We came back up into the airport and we flew home. And we're just in now this minute.
Margaret Galligan with Mary Wilson on Drive Time. Another new show on the 2FM schedule this week is a morning programme presented by Jennifer Zamparelli. She had Tricia Lewis on, who was hard to turn off.
My weight that I started was 26 stone. The day that was my heaviest record. My heaviest was actually 27, and that was for a gastric bypass that I'd booked, but I didn't go through with it. So I was miserable, I think, for about 4 years properly. Like from the 20 to 26 stone wasn't fun. Like leading up to 20 stone, great crack. Late nights, parties, drinking.
Takeaways.
Mom, takeaway. Live life like, you know, like a king. Just didn't care.
Yeah.
But
and is that what it was? Was it the case that you just didn't care? You're just... Because I find now, girls especially, and the girls that I work with in the office and on the team, like sometimes we're so bloody self-conscious of what we're eating. Like, were you not self-conscious at a point? Like, we're overly self-conscious. Like, we think about it far too much.
Well, my weight self-conscious, yes. Yeah. All my life, I think since I was about 5 years of age, maybe no, I was a little bit older, about 8, I kind of heard the word fat for the first time ever and I was like, what did they just say? Like, well, what does that mean, you know? And I remember I was actually really at the same moment at bingo and I poked my friend in the side.
Yeah.
And I was like, what in the name of God was that? And it was like a ribcage. So I started like touching my sides and I was like, and then I was like, Avril, come here a minute. And I drove my hand into her again.
Did you pull her aside and go, Avril, I think there's something wrong with you.
I can feel your right. I remember my head going, oh my God, I am fat. Do you know? And that's only a small memory now. It didn't make me go on my cry. I played on my bingo and I continued on.
Yeah.
With my bag of Maltesers or whatever it was. Do you know, it wasn't. So all my life I would have been conscious, but I would have also been confident, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So I wasn't like the cliche fat person who was confident but wasn't. I actually was genuinely confident.
Good.
So then when I hit 20 stone, then that's when it got frightening for me because I lost my confidence. I lost my happiness. I lost the way to look at life positively. I couldn't see the wood from the trees. It was just... Everyone was
so
horrible
was it,
and I was horrible.
Well, was it a case that you just felt a little bit invincible? Like, I'll never get to that size. Do you know what I mean? Were
no,
you just...
I don't think so. I think I always thought I'd be able to fix this.
Yeah.
That once I make that decision now to lose weight, it'll be fine.
Yeah.
And then I would do like a crash diet or I would go mental at the gym and I would do it really, really well.
Or Monday. Monday. I'll start on Monday.
Future Trisha was the biggest liar I ever met in my entire
life.
She was.
Yeah.
She
was they're awful. Nasty. Future Jen is a pain in the hole.
She was just, I do it Monday and Monday never, ever came.
Yeah.
So then I would do it and I would do like Lipotrim or I would do like shakes or I would do healthy eating and exercise but do it really intensely that it wasn't sustainable. So I always thought I'd be able to come out of it. So that's why it wasn't like I wasn't worried, if that makes sense. I wasn't like, oh, I don't care, I'm fat, I don't care. It was I thought I'd come out of it. And then when I realised how far I'd gotten, that's when the kind of laughing and the kind of, oh, I'm getting away with it stopped because I knew I was in serious trouble.
So tell me, when you realise it's not going to be Monday, it's today. Did you go and talk to someone? Did you speak to your family? I know you have 8 sisters. Did you chat to them? What was the first step?
Well, they've tried all their lives to help. None of them suffer with weight. Now, also because they work hard at it, they eat healthy, they run marathons, and I was kind of the only one kind of going, oh, poor me, and I just thought I had really bad metabolism.
Yeah.
But so I suppose it was December of 2017 was when it kind of started coming to a head for me because I'd never go to my family and go, you know, I'm conscious of my weight, because then it gave them a leeway to talk to me about something I wasn't able to deal with because I didn't know what was. I was actually very depressed. That was wrong of me. So then on December 2017, my sister had twin boys, and whatever happened with the naps, she missed Christmas dinner. So we were like, we'll bring the dinners down, she, and come up when they're relaxed.
Good on you.
So then we instead of walking it, which I do now in 20 seconds, I was like, I'll drive it because that's how sore my legs and everything were. So I hopped into dad's car and I got stuck behind the wheel and I couldn't turn the wheel.
Right.
So my sister was beside me and she was 6 months pregnant as well. And I remember just turning to her and I was like, can you do me a favour and don't tell the girls? And she was like, look, I won't. No, she told me that evening she went home Ballingrain. Then in January, I think she was using it as a ploy. She was like, will you come and see the scan with me? So I was like, yeah, cool. She was like, so we went to, and there and then the hospital, she was like, look, I can't enjoy my pregnancy with this. She was like, I need to talk to you. I can't look forward to new life when I think you're going to go on me. So we were crying mad. We didn't see the scan. And I think that was the moment that I didn't go, yes, I'm going to join the gym. It was like, oh my God, life is actually going to end if I don't cop on. Now, I was also riddled in anxiety in the maternity hospital because I was afraid someone would be like, when you do, girl? And I'd be like, not inside our legs, just McDonald's girls. You know, and there was a lever in the chair and it was when I pulled that up.
Yeah.
And I had to sit on two and Marie was like, I really need to talk to you here now. So I was like, so she cornered me basically. So then that evening,
They did the typical art. They guilted you.
They did, and it was from the heart. She was like, "Man, you can't sleep.
Course.
No one can sleep. Like, you need to cop on." And I remember I actually had a huge argument with my sister a few months ago because she kept knocking on my door, being like, "Morning, could we go 5:45?" Like, and I'd be like, "Why are we saying morning?" But she was actually just terrified that I died in my sleep. There was that kind of
anxiety. That fear.
Yeah. So we'd war. I'd be like, you actually wake me once more. And she was like, oh, I'm just saying morning.
You'll be
and
dead.
Stuff. But then after she was like, Trish, why do you think I was doing that? I didn't want to deal with the Rottweiler behind the door.
Yeah.
She was like, oh my God, morning, is she alive? And then like a White Walker come out of the bed. I was like, what you want?
But I have to say, you're a beautiful girl. You've done so much. But did you date in that time? Like, were you seeing lads? You weren't.
No. And a few people have asked me that question. They're like, would you date someone if they were 26 stone? And it's such a controversial thing, but I would say no because, and they said at work, they were like, that's horrible. I'm like, no, it's not for looks. It's not for judgment.
Mm.
But I know if you're 26 stone, you're not happy. Like I never went around along the lines of going, well, nobody fences me. Nobody likes. I never played that pity card because how could I expect anyone to love me when I couldn't stand the sight of the mirror.
Yeah.
So that's why I didn't date or didn't even try. Now, Chancellor a few weeks ago, terrible experience with Bumble.
Oh, tell
it
us.
It was so funny.
Tell me
straight away. My friends were like,
go
for Bumble because the girls need to message first. So I was like, that's grand. Not grand. That's not cool because I'm like, hello.
What did you say?
So I did swipe to the gorgeous looking boys. I was
of course
like,
you did.
Oh, no flaws getting in here, boys. Did you know? So this guy was like, where are you based? And I was like, I'm based in Cork. And he goes, oh God, I'm based in Dublin. How did that happen? And the algorithm must be off. And then I was like, God, there must be a hole in the system. And he replied, well, you've certainly got a big hole. And I was like, so I just replied, I was like, well, my big hole can squat more than you. Goodbye.
Nice.
Like, oh, but it was very funny. So I was like, maybe put that away because I don't want to put myself forward on a dating app because I don't want anyone to judge me because I'm not judging myself anymore.
Yeah.
So why should I be like, please like me. If you don't like me, move on.
You are a very happy person. And what is it? So what are you doing daily now that you weren't doing before?
Minding myself. Giving myself time. Like looking after Trish. Down to showering. I know it's a very hard one to say, but that was a struggle. I couldn't get out of my own head to get into the shower because mainly I couldn't fit into it, which was really annoying. And now it's just brushing my teeth, having breakfast.
Are you afraid? Is there always a constant fear then that you'll fall off the wagon? Because I know you told a story about you falling off the wagon when you went to London. What happened there?
I put on loads of weight. Yeah. I put on like 15 pounds. No, that was Berlin.
Berlin, okay.
No, we had a ball. And I remember coming back.
Yeah, I tell you had a ball.
Oh,
you put on bleeding 15 pounds.
I was like, can't say yes for... Is that the bread? Yeah, no matter. Just give it over now. But I remember coming back and I was allergic and I was like an antichrist. And then my sister turned and she was like, you need to just cop on now and stop with the pity brigade. But she was like, because you wouldn't have had that fun. We went into a bar for one more drink and we left at 6 a.m. Like, we were bananas.
Yeah.
We had great crack, you know. Mm. And she was like, Trisha, old Trisha wouldn't have done that. You would have gained the 15 pounds by secretly eating in the hotel room while everybody else went out. She was like, so look, what you do is you move on and maybe next time go for a gin and slimline, not 7 daiquiris and go mad.
Yeah.
So yeah, it does happen. Negativity does creep back in. Demons do pop back in, but it's kind of like, I kind of describe it like a haunted house. You kind of have to kind of decorate it in the way you want it. And that front door does not open for anyone that's nasty. Because you can be, that was my biggest downside. I didn't believe in myself and I was an absolute bitch to myself, if that makes sense.
Tricia Lewis with Jennifer Zamparelli on 2FM. On Radio 1, Strings Attached was a tribute to Joni Mitchell.
Songs are like tattoos. You know, I've been to sea before. Crown and anchor me, or let me sail away. Hey, blue, and there is a song for you. Ink on a pin, underneath the skin, an empty space to fill in. Well, there's so many sinking now. You've got to keep thinking you can make it through these waves. Acid, booze and ass, needles, guns and grass, lots of laughs. Lots of laughs. Everybody's saying that hell's the hippest way to go. Well, I don't think so. But I'm going to take a look around it. Though blue, I love you. Here is a shell for you. Inside, you'll hear a sigh, a foggy lullaby. There is your song from me.
Blue by Joni Mitchell, performed by Marina Carr, accompanied by Brian Connor on piano and Mick Sievers on clarinet, and that was on Radio 1 on Monday. And Blue was the theme of Arena later that day, with the whole show given over to movies, music and writing referring to the colour. Sinead Gleeson chose a book called Bluets by Maggie Nelson to talk about.
It's in 240 numbered sections, which she calls propositions, and it's an experiment with form. So they can be read as a couple of lines or a paragraph, and they can be read independently. But obviously it's a cohesive book and it moves kind of chronologically forward. But it's a meditation on mortality and life and love and sex and death. But it's also very playful. So it starts, the very first line in the book is, suppose I was to tell you I fell in love with the colour. And she says that she has had this lifelong ardour for the colour blue. She asked people, all of her friends, to send her blue things. She calls them her blue correspondence, you know, so blue stones, blue jewellery, blue pots of dye. But throughout the book, she talks about other writers' engagements, so Gass and Wittgenstein and Goethe and Plato, and how other people deal with colour. But also she talks about why she loves it and what she's learned from history. So she talks about the male satin bowerbird, which lines its nest with blue stolen things, so feathers and bus tickets to attract a female mate. She talks about how, before the Aztecs removed their victims' hearts. They used to smear blue paint on their chests. She also interestingly talks about eisenoblepsia, which is apparently connected to Viagra, where some sufferers have a kind of a slight blue tinge to their sight. I think Viagra was possibly mentioned by somebody else, or yeah, will be in the course of this program. But it's a, I just think it's a playful sort of wonderful engagement with form, and it's a deep dive into a colour without it. It's very philosophical in places. It's very playful in places. But you learn an awful lot by reading this book. And I think that Nelson is just somebody who has gotten even more. One of my favourite lines in the whole book, she talks about looking at a window. And you know, you see blue plastic bags caught on a hedge.
Yeah, yeah.
And she said, can those kind of bags, or the, you know, the bright blue tarpaulins you see over a shanty in a small town, can they be the fingerprints of God?
Bluets by Maggie Nelson, as described by Sinead Gleeson. This week was also, as you know, the 75th anniversary of the D-Day landings in Normandy. Liveline marked it by speaking with one of those who was there on the day.
Dennis Boardman, good afternoon.
That's me, yeah.
Yeah. What rank were you on this day 75 years ago, Dennis?
I was a corporal.
Okay, so Corporal Dennis Boardman, bring me back 75 years. Corporal Boardman, where were you at midnight last night?
Midnight, it had just been cancelled. Mm. It had been cancelled. We should have gone on the 5th of June.
Yeah.
But the weather was too bad, so we went.
So what time yesterday, Dennis, Corporal Boardman, did you get word that the D-Day was on?
We got word about 6 hours before we were due to leave.
Okay.
We were in transit camp waiting for the previous week.
And where did you depart from?
Depart from Bryce Norton in Oxfordshire.
So you were in a plane, obviously.
Yeah, but the plane wasn't a normal plane that you would see today. You would see a Dakota. We were in a plane which was called an Albemarle. And normally, the Albemarle was only used for towing gliders.
Oh, of course,
but
yeah.
We ended up in an Albemarle, and you couldn't stand up in an Albemarle. You had to sit down and crouch. And we had to do that for the hour and a half journey before we jumped.
Okay, I know you're now living in Cork, but take us back again. At midnight last night, 75 years ago, what happened, Dennis?
Well, we took off from Bryce Norton,
mm-hmm,
and we circled round for an hour and met other aircraft, and then we jumped about 2 minutes before midnight.
Okay.
And when I jumped, there was actually a German searchlight actually on the plane I jumped from, and I passed through the beam of the searchlight.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I got within about 20 feet of the ground, I had a kit bag strapped to my right leg.
Okay.
With a radio set in it, so mm-hmm, which I had to communicate with people as soon as I landed. It was a radio set plus my kit, but I couldn't get rid of the radio set, which would normally be on the end of a rope in a kit bag.
Okay.
But I couldn't release it, and I had to land with the kit bag and the radio set still strapped to my last leg. And I badly sprained my ankle, but I couldn't do anything about it, so I went on and carried on with a damaged ankle for the next week.
Wow. So it's now, you're now 14 hours in France, 75 years ago, Dennis.
Yeah.
Did you come under attack at all this morning?
Oh, yeah, we came under attack within about 6 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And there was about a thousand Germans attacked us. And there was a pile of gliders lying in the big fields close to where we were in the village of Roundville,
mm-hmm,
and there was over 1,000 Germans attacked us, and we waited. We hid in Roundville, a group of us, and then we waited till the Germans were virtually only about 10 or 15 yards from us, old pile of them, and then we were let rip with our machine guns. And the Germans retreated very quickly. So it made it easier for us after that.
Dennis Boardman from Liveline on Radio 1.
Playback on RTE Radio 1.
The Rolling Wave featured the songs of a man named John Riley. One particular song tells the story of doomed love.
And he knocked all at the door. Out comes the Reverend Mother, and she tearing galore. Saying, your true love is not here, sir. She is left this here last night. She is gone to some asylum where she's fractured in mind.
She's gone to the asylum. She has lost her mind.
The programme then played Christy Moore's interpretation of John Riley's song.
Softly falls the dew. I'm sorry, my true love, will forever part from you. The count rode to the asylum. He arrived at first light. The story that they gave to him was that she died here last night. Let me in there, cried the captain. Let me in there, the captain cried. Let me in there until I see her, till I stand by her side. Green grows the laurel, and softly falls the dew. I'm sorry, my true lover, forever parting from you. Standing by her left side, his sharp sword in the room. He gave her great attention as he pierced his heart through. Sand was their misfortune, sorrowful to fate, to see two loyal lovers lying together in one place. Green grows the laurel, softly falls the dew. I'm sorry, my true lover, forever parting from you.
John Riley and Christy Moore from The Rolling Wave on Sunday night.
This morning I drove down Doncaster Avenue and I slowed down outside number 27.
On Sunday morning, Sunday Miscellany also dealt with doomed romance and a brass plate on a hall table.
And it's on that brass plate that I came home every Tuesday fortnight from work to find a letter from, well, let's call him James Conlon.
Carol Nicholas met her, James, when they both worked in the library service.
While unpacking a delivery, I came across a green library index card addressed to me with a red Fox's fruit suite attached to it by a length of sellotape.
But then, after all the letters and dates, Carol's James had news.
Just before Christmas, he phoned to say he was going to London to look for work. But I'll ring you next week, he said. I'll write letters to you next week. But next week the brass plate on the hall table was bare. And again the next week, bare. And again and again and again, bare. And the sight of that bare brass plate bore into me and followed me daily up the stairs to my empty, cluttered room. No letter ever came. I would never hear from him again. Anguish, I thought. Anguish is an empty brass plate on a hall table in a house on Doncaster Avenue.
Carol Nicholas from Sunday Miscellany. And on the same programme, Pat Dunn talked about the latest craze in Finland.
In essence, it involves running about while straddling a wooden stick topped with a toy horse's head. In other words, a hobby horse. But what's happened in Finland is that teenage girls have taken up hobby horsing as a competitive sport. At equestrian-style events in sports arenas and outdoor parks, competitors clutching the reins of their hobby horses leap over fences like show jumpers, or elegantly prance about like dressage horses.
But as Pat says, Finland has form here.
Finland also hosts an annual competition to find the world's best air guitar player, an activity that makes show jumping with a toy horse seem entirely sensible.
Pat Dunn from Sunday Miscellany. In a similar vein, Seascapes featured a sort of mad competition. The programme was at the Baltimore Wooden Boat Festival, and one of the events there was to build a boat in a day and race it. Fergal Keane spoke to the winner.
Barely took on any water, maybe just a pint at most, but yeah, very bad.
And you're also the only one that didn't sink.
Yes, that's the truth of it. The other lads unfortunately didn't make it more than halfway, but hopefully next year we'll have a bit more floating competition at least.
You even had a sail, but it didn't really work very well.
Yeah, the sail was a bit chaotic on the way back with the wind blowing the other way. We couldn't really steer it to get back, so we kind of ended up a bit into the rocks and had to paddle back at the end, but I'm sure it worked well.
Do you get a prize?
Well, last year there was T-shirts sort of going around, so hopefully I can get myself a new outfit, you know?
There's a man with his priorities on right, Zachary Laplow from Seascapes. And that's almost it for the week, and thank you to those who wrote with suggestions to playback at rte.ie. Back on Friday next with the podcast, and on Saturday with the broadcast. And before we part, one last mention of the summer holidays.
Are we there yet?
Well, Ryan Tuberty certainly thinks he is, because although he was broadcasting from the Wild Atlantic Way, one little slip revealed something about how difficult a job that has been this week.
I just think a pint of stout tastes better when you're on your holidays. I'm not I'm not on my holidays. Oh my God. Okay, that was a slip, but there you are. Maybe that's I forgot where I was for a minute. We mentioned that's the biggest compliment you could pay to the Wild Atlantic Way, right?
Ryan Tuberty. Until next week, Slán.
Playback on RTE Radio 1.